Welcome to Two-Way Street. My guest today is Faith Saley. You probably know her as a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and as a commentator on CBS Sunday Morning. She's also the host of the PBS TV show Science Goes to the Movies. Earlier in her career, Saley was a regular on a number of TV series, including Star Trek Deep Space Nine. She lives in New York, but she grew up here in Metro Atlanta in Dunwoody. Saley's just published a new book, Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. It's a series of very frank and humorous essays about her once unquenchable need to win the approval of just about everyone around her and the lengths she'd go to gain validation. Approval Junkie covers a lot of ground, from her obsessive four-year quest to win a beauty contest at North Springs High School, to the complete failure of her frantic efforts to please Bill O'Reilly when he invited her on the O'Reilly Factor. Along the way, she tells stories about making out with Matt Damon and fending off the groping advances of Battlestar Galactica legend Edward James Olmos at a Comic-Con convention of all places. I mean, is nothing sacred? You'll hear about all of that and more in our conversation. Welcome to Two-Way Street, Faith. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
What's an approval junkie?
I would say an approval junkie is someone who is human enough to admit that approval feels good. Now, I would not say it's a people pleaser, because that can sort of condemn you to mediocrity if you're trying to please tons of people, and not a perfectionist, right? Because perfectionists don't try because they think they might fail. I think an approval junkie is so after the high five or the applause or the laughter that an approval junkie is willing to embarrass herself and stretch herself and truly try to please her toughest critic, which is herself, like always trying to prove something to yourself. I have two little kids. My daughter turns two this week, and my son is almost four. And I mean, seeking approval is a milestone, right? They are supposed to want their parents' approval when they do good things, right? And then at some point, we get to an age where it's magically supposed to disappear. And we live in this culture where people think it's cool to say, I don't care what anybody else thinks. I don't care about getting approval. Well, I would suggest an approval junkie is someone who does care. My own evolution, the evolution of my relationship with approval is that I don't want it indiscriminately now, right? I want it from people whom I admire and who inspire me. So I work on these great shows. I work on CBS Sunday Morning. I work on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Do I want the approval of my colleagues and my producers there? Yeah. They're really smart people. I was a fan of those shows before I was ever on them. But I would also say that I don't regret any of it. So if there were times when I have sought validation, quote unquote, too much, I mean, these essays, I hope, go to prove that I learned something valuable from it. So, I mean, it is adventures in caring too much, and I would always want to err. My husband keeps insisting the word is pronounced err.
I think he's right.
I think he is.
But it sounds weird,
I know.
Doesn't it?
Yes. Err on the side of trying too hard. It's like what? Are there other words that we mispronounce that?
Sure. How many times do people call you Faith Saley?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, all the time. So thank you. I still get a little frisson of glee when you pronounce my last name Saley.
Yeah,
so thank you.
I get it. You talk early in your book about women needing probably having greater needs as approval junkies than men.
Yeah, I think there are many. I don't know if I'd say that women need it. I think maybe women seek approval more than men. And I would say there are so many more ways we can get approval or disapproval than men. I mean, you know, what is wonderful for women nowadays is we have more choices than ever, right? But I don't think that most men worry about the kind of fathers they're being. I don't, you know, when nobody asks my husband, are you a working dad? There are, you know, women are thinking things as superficial as heels versus flat or Botox versus bangs. And for whatever reasons, I think our culture, society, history has, biology has created a situation where we do put ourselves on pedestals to get tiaras. Nobody's watching Mr. America on TV, you know?
Can we listen to somebody whose approval you really wanted and then have you tell a story about it?
Yeah.
With us now, social observer Faith Saley, former Rhodes Scholar, among other things. All right, so when does it become enough's enough?
So we won't even go through
Papa
that.
Papa Bear.
Bill O'Reilly. You were on the O'Reilly Factor. How did that work out for you?
Not well. I was on twice, but it was... I was asked to come on the show under this idea that, you know, you seem like a fun liberal gal who can, like, you know, I thought Bill and I would be the Benedict and Beatrice of Fox News. You know, we'll have this great playful dynamic and I'll come back regularly. That's what I was sort of auditioning to be, was a regular on the show. And again, it was a matter, I think, of trying too hard. I mean, look, he named me a social observer, whatever that means. And you know, I did, particularly between leaving acting and finding my place on Sunday morning and on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and I also host a show on PBS called Science Goes to the Movies. Before I sort of landed in those places, I had this strange kind of career, if you can call it that, as one of those people who goes on whatever show and tries to make jokes and say something meaningful.
Well, talk about needing approval. I mean, how much more difficult can it be? Your preparation to do the O'Reilly show, the way you describe it in the book, was so intense.
It's embarrassingly intense. So I read he had his bestseller, Bold, Fresh Piece of Humanity, which is his memoir. That was out. So I totally, you know, doubled down on that and knew everything about him. I was thinking when I went on his show, and by the way, you get whatever, 4 minutes to talk about whatever he wants to. Fair enough, it's his show. And Bill O'Reilly is known for interrupting people. And so I had all these fabulous bon mots prepared. You know, I'd drop lines about his favorite nun in high school or something. And that's not what I was there for. You know, I was there to be fit into his show and be part of that machine. And I didn't do it very well.
But you had a good first appearance.
I had a good first appearance. But I did. I made him laugh a few times. And got in a few of my jokes that weren't sort of aborted by interruptions. And then I was surprised when they asked. So then the next day, a producer said, you know, Bill has an idea. When can you talk? Bill has this idea for something he'd like to make ongoing. So I can talk now. I wanted Bill O'Reilly to be my TV boyfriend. And they wanted to do this thing called the dumbest thing of the week, where I would go in at the end of every week with another woman. So Bill was already pulling another woman into our relationship. She was blonde, Bill, and much tanner than I was and much more fit for Fox News and conservative. And so, of course, I said yes. I wanted to keep things fresh. There was three of us in this relationship now. And when we tried the first dumbest thing of the week, I knew. They give you talking points oftentimes mm-hmm. when you go on these shows. So there's no spontaneity. And often the producers, if you're even there to be funny, they want to know ahead of time what your jokes are going to be, which I always think spoils the whole thing. Because not only, I mean, there's spontaneity is, you did improv for years. Spontaneity is always the best.
It helps.
Yeah. So I ended up spending part of my day. I knew that Bill O'Reilly was going to say something negative about President Obama, something about that had happened then. This was years ago. And I actually knew someone at the White House press office, and I spent time that day calling the White House press office and getting facts about what happened and what didn't happen. And I thought that I'm gonna crush it. Like, I'm gonna be such a great commentator on Bill's show when I come back. And I didn't tell them ahead of time I had done this. And so when I went on the show and said, well, you know, Bill made his point, which I don't think was true and was definitely negative about the president. And I said, well, actually, Bill, I called the White House press office today and spoke to them and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I could see it in his eyes. Like all the fun of the dumbest thing menage a trois was gone and I was not doing what I was supposed to do. And so I told him what I had learned. And he said, and you believe that? This is at the very end of the segment. And you believe that? No wonder your name is Faith. And it felt like my name was a dirty word. And everybody, even the camera people laughed and the other woman laughed and they went right to commercial. And it was just like, you know, I overshot.
Yeah.
Overshot. I wasn't there to be like a news hound. I was there to be a social commentator, a liberal one.
Did it ever occur to you, because of O'Reilly's well-known reputation, it's not like we're dishing about him in a way that isn't already very public.
Are we talking about falafels?
Well, I mean, just in general, this is a guy who likes women.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a guy, it strikes me, who it seems to me that as an attractive woman, it might, you somewhere in your brain, you might have wondered, even when you were first invited, aside from the fact that clearly his staff thought you were good for the show, funny, that there's also this, oh, here's another babe for Bill O'Reilly to have on the show with him. Did that ever cross your mind?
Not really, because okay. I had done some other stuff at Fox. I had been on other shows.
Yeah, but this is Bill O'Reilly.
I feel like the women at Fox are so much more beautiful than I am and fit a mold that I thought, you know what I did think? I thought they wouldn't ask me on if they didn't think I was attractive enough to sit in what they call the legs chair. They have tall chairs at Fox, and they ask you, you're supposed to wear a skirt and you're supposed to show your legs. And when you go through the hair and makeup room at Fox, it is a factory. They do make everybody, there is a Fox look, and it's glossy pink lips and like wide Real Housewives hair.
Did you like it when you were sitting in the makeup chair and they started that for you and you looked at yourself?
So
did you like what you saw in the mirror?
No, I like having hair and makeup. That's for sure.
Sure.
But it looked so, it looked like I was auditioning to be a Charlie's Angel. And they put on really dark, like a spray tan on your face. And it didn't look like me. It was very, it felt funny.
Did you ever talk to O'Reilly again?
No.
So, again, misapproval junkie, you got some great feedback in social media for your appearances on Fox.
Can I read? I don't know if I can read some.
Well, you can. We'll end up having to bleep it.
So, yeah, one of the hazards of doing what I do for a living, which is often express my opinion, is to get sort of deluged by disapproval. And what I'm so dumb. I didn't anticipate. The first time I was on Bill O'Reilly's show, I thought it went so well, and I didn't really anticipate what the feedback would be from his fans. And, I mean, you know, these are people who think there should be a draft for the war on Christmas, right? should I just read?
Sure.
Well, some of them you won't even have to, yeah. This is, and people signed them with their full names, sometimes their addresses. You really don't have much of a sense of humor for a fat ass's skank.
Is this coming to you in an email?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Emails. Mm-hmm. Here's a good one. It was simple. It was just one line. And you're a complete tool because, followed by 5 question marks. That was from Jay in Vanessa, like, you know, Jay and Vanessa, which I just imagine is this couple who likes to watch The O'Reilly Factor together. Send hate mail. Oh, this is good. You have a stupid airline slut appearance, you cow-like creature. Very disgusting. Smelly-like, you slutty bitch. Fondest regards, Steve B.
Okay, so that's fun. That's plenty. Unless there's another favorite really want to read.
Yeah, this is a good one. You should stick to failed comedy attempts and leave the thinking to men. Play to your strengths, then people won't keep mistaking you for a fire hydrant, and you'll stay much drier. That was signed Manhood 101.
Oh, great. What's interesting about that is you, in addition to having done that show just a couple times, obviously you've had a bigger TV career, including the CBS Sunday Morning commentaries. And, of course, that's a much more elevated and refined crowd watching that show.
Oh, yeah.
So if you were to do, say, a commentary in which you talked about pets your aversion to having one, if you were going to get any reaction at all, it would be a much more kind of...
Nuanced,
intellectual sort of approach. Right? Tell us this story.
So, right, wrong. I thought it would be, again, this is my learning curve with these shows I'm on. I thought it would be, this was back when I started on CBS Sunday Morning, and they had an animal show. And at the end, I thought it would be cheeky and funny and contrarian to do a commentary called I Am Not a Pet Person. Well, let me tell you. People who love Fox News and guns and et cetera are much sweeter than people who love animals. This was, and by the way, it was a really innocuous commentary. I said, which is the truth, I love animals. I would love your dog. I think animals are great. They lower your blood pressure. They can call 911. I just don't want a pet. I don't want a pet. And if you will, like, not call me Cruella De Vil for not wanting a pet, then I won't call you crazy for giving your dog a bark mitzvah or dressing it up like Abraham Lincoln on Halloween, right? And I got probably 500 hateful comments into Facebook, to my personal address, to the CBS News website. And they were, I mean, this is the Christian Sabbath when people took the time to write this. They were so personal and so hateful. It was shocking. You've never been unconditionally loved. No wonder your husband divorced you. You don't deserve to live on this planet. I mean, get more. One of them was like, get more sun.
All right. So how do you reconcile the kind of horrible, hateful comments that you can sometimes get? How do you were very upset about this.
I was very upset.
And your husband, John, your second husband, not your husband, which is a very funny thing. We're not going to have time to get into a lot of that, but it's in the book. He said, why do you, baby, he calls you baby,
yes,
right?
Yes, he does.
Why do you pay attention?
And he, by the way, he has two dogs. He had two dogs at the time, yeah. Yeah, and he's my husband is much more evolved than I am. and he did. He said, you know, I actually read all those comments. I pored over them. When he had taken me away for my 40th birthday, we were in Prague. And it was a beautiful night, and I'm there in the lobby of a former monastery in Prague reading these comments. Just truly, what I realized later was just feeding my ego, because you're not brave to read negative comments about yourself. You're reading them because they still tell you on some level you matter. You matter enough that people are saying hateful things about you. So I was starting to cry, and he came in, and this is when I was new to the show. I didn't realize that, A, I probably shouldn't take on the most controversial topics if I don't want that much disapproval, and I didn't know that animals were so controversial. And B, I don't read the comments anymore. I try not to. But yeah, he grabbed me by the shoulders and he said, like, this doesn't matter. Look where we are. And why does this doesn't matter? You can't, what did he say? He said, you can't let them have, you know, give in to that kind of energy.
But it's hard not to, isn't it? You feel as if you want to say, reach out to that person, no matter how hateful, and say, no, you misunderstood.
Totally.
You don't understand who I am.
No, that's exactly right. You totally misunderstood me. And also, I'm human. Like, yeah. Would you ever send such a thing to anyone you know? Social media is it's harsh. It's hard. And, you know, so here's this book that I've written called Approval Junkies with my very personal stories. And that's this kind of situation writ large. There will certainly be reviews. You know, I'm always wondering, should I read this review or should I not read this review?
We're going to take a break now. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Faith Saley. Her new book is Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. If you're just joining us, my guest is Faith Saley. She's the author of Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. She's a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a commentator on CBS Sunday Morning, and the host of the PBS TV show Science Goes to the Movies. But Saley began her career with aspirations to be an actress, well, really a star. She was a regular on several TV series, including Star Trek Deep Space Nine. During her years as an actress, she lived in L.A. with her first husband, producer Nick Holly. It was not a happy marriage, as Saley reports throughout her book. We should point out that your husband, your first husband, your husband had a major career in the entertainment business. He actually produced or was creating a TV series with a character based on you. And, of course, you were the first choice to play the part, weren't you?
Yeah, the character was created for me. It was even named Hope. My name is Faith, and I didn't get it. I didn't get it.
We need somebody more like Faith Saley.
We need a Faith Saley type, but you're not it. That was the worst... That was definitely the Nader, I never know how to pronounce that word, of my of my career, and was also the worst, the darkest part of my marriage. That was when my husband asked me if I would consider having an exorcism.
You talk about your husband, your first husband, and the difficulty. It was a very hard relationship, obviously.
Yeah, it was,
You say he didn't want to have sex with you. That's a revelation that takes a lot of courage to bring to our attention in a book. Why did you want to talk about that?
It was so, honestly, the only reason I wouldn't have put that in, which it was so fundamental to the problems in our relationship, was more to protect him. I don't mind people knowing that my ex, my husband, didn't want to have sex with me.
He didn't want to see you naked. He didn't want to go shopping with
he
you.
He didn't
want you to show your wedding pictures to anyone.
No, he didn't even want to look at them together. He didn't want me to see him naked, by the way.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he didn't mind seeing me naked.
Oh, okay.
And that was...
Thank God.
Really? No, that was what was confusing. He was alternately a big champion and then my judge. You know, it was like being in a relationship with my husband was just like scratching an itch over and over for an approval junkie, because I could never quite get his approval. But you know, we started out so well. We started out with him telling me I was his dream girl, and then I felt like I fell off the pedestal and could never get back up. But I'm a person who wants to, you know. I was living in LA then. My mother had just died. I was seeking love wherever I could get it, and I was ready to audition over and over to be his dream girl again.
Because you're sitting here in a studio in Atlanta, it seems to me we really have to go to the essay in this book that
I know
deals
where you're headed.
With
you're driving towards Sandy
where
Springs.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dunwoody, Georgia.
Yeah.
And I went to North Springs High School on Roswell Road.
You know, you point out in the book that there's some pretty famous alums, starting with John Schneider.
Yes, who was the only famous alumnus when I went there. Yes, so that would be Bo Duke, everybody.
Exactly, Dukes of Hazzard.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, when you were a student at North Springs, did you aspire to have the kind of career that John Schneider did?
Sure, I wanted to be a TV star. Yeah, I didn't know if I could hop in and out of cars, but I mean, you know.
But since then,
right? There's Usher.
Yep.
And Raven Simone.
But you, from the time you were a freshman, as you say in the essay in this book.
Mm-hmm.
There was one shining goal.
Yes, Bill.
What was it?
I was determined to be Miss Aphrodite, goddess of beauty and love. That was the North Springs, back in the day, that was the North Springs High School pageant, a beauty and talent pageant for its girls, for its young ladies.
And you worked at this.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, there was an unwritten rule that you couldn't win until you're a senior, but I was undaunted. I mean, I gave it my all freshman, sophomore, junior, and then senior year to get the tiara.
Yeah. What was the first song you sang as a contestant for Miss Aphrodite?
Yeah, it's generous to say singing, because I chose a song called Nothing from a chorus line that is mostly spoken. It's largely spoken.
Yeah.
And you may know, Bill, that this song is famously for a Latina named Morales.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember any of that song?
Oh,
can you sing any of it for us?
Every day for a week, we would try to feel the
motion.
Feel the motion down the hill every day for a week. Yes. So I looked right down to the bottom of my soul to see what I had inside. Yeah. So it's about an actress with her acting coach who keeps telling her, like, I don't believe you, you know, feel the cold, feel the motion, feel whatever. And she could never feel it. And he would tell her that she will amount to nothing.
She's in an improv class in high school. So she's still a young, fragile soul. And that's right. The song is really very touching.
It is touching.
Because nothing she does is right.
Right.
But Mr. Karp.
Ah, very good.
Can't stand her in the class. But let's stay with North Springs.
Mm-hmm.
You made the effort freshman year.
And I got first runner-up. I mean, I was in a cobalt blue unitard with red dance panties that I kept picking out the wedgie. And I got first runner-up. And I attribute that not only to the unitard, but to my very pandering answer during the during the interview portion because I had decided that no matter what they asked me, my answer would be Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., y'all. And it just so happened that my chosen answer lined up stunningly with the question, which was, what person do you admire most and why? Now, how do you not admire Martin Luther King Jr.? But honestly, at age 14, I didn't know much about him except that many streets in Atlanta were named after him, right?
But in fact, your real answer would have been...
whom do I admire most?
Yeah.
Would be like Molly Ringwald,
right.
Y'all. Because,
right.
You know, have you seen The Breakfast Club?
Right.
She's awesome and then some.
Right.
Then I went on a couple more years.
I'll tell you what. We're going to build to your senior year.
Mm-hmm.
The big night that you were competing in the talent contest. And this is part of the song that you sang that night.
Oh, my gosh.
Blow the bugle.
Oh, my gosh.
Sound the cymbal. All my troubles fill a thimble. I'm as happy as it's legal to be.
Oh, my gosh.
Barbra Streisand from Funny Lady, right?
I haven't heard that song since I was 17 years old. Because it's an awful song and nobody plays it, but it's amazing you found that.
Why did you pick that song?
I didn't pick it, Bill. I picked that song because it was picked for me by Valerie Kennedy. God, I wonder if she's still around and listening. She lived in Atlanta. Maybe it was Decatur. She was the pageant. She was like the Bella Caroli. Of pageant coaches. She could take you, Bill, and turn you into Miss Peachtree City.
Yeah. Let's listen to the big finish to this song.
You've been banished by a royal decree. And your head feels so good when you finally clear it. If I saw a woman, I would fall. Here it come on then.
Breath control. For me. By the way, did you note the lyric, those oogly boogly feelings are free? These are like the worst lyrics.
It's not
ever.
Sondheim.
No.
Are you up for reading?
I would love to.
If you would, I was really kind of touched by, you know, let me say this about your book first. You're obviously very funny, and there's a lot
Thank
of
you.
Very humorous material in this book. But there's also a lot of passages in here that are really quite moving. You're very revealing.
Thank you.
And there are places where you really move us. So would you read the end of your essay about Miss Aphrodite?
I love to read this one. So I will start by saying I still have that tiara that I won. I still have it. And there are some like rhinestones missing and the comb is missing to shove it into my hair. But in some ways it makes me like a Tennessee Williams character, right? Just clinging to the symbol of my salad days. Like just salad, y'all. Dressing
You're not
on the
quite
side.
Blanche DuBois.
Right, but close. Or Amanda Wingfield. So here's kind of why I still have that tiara. About a week after I won, I received rejection letters from all the Ivies, and Jennifer Lindy got to be valedictorian. On prom night, my dad took me out to dinner because no one had asked me. But for one brief shining moment, the Greek gods had smiled on me and welcomed me into their pantheon as Miss Aphrodite, goddess of beauty and love. I love casually telling people I won my high school pageant. In the Northeast, in this century, it sounds positively exotic. I faux brag about being Miss Aphrodite 1989 because it's so ridiculous, but the truth is I have a wistfulness about it. I remember it clearly as one of the last times I set goals to dominate my body and to captivate the student body, certain I could achieve them through sheer determination. And that's a faith that belongs to the young, because you learn soon enough that life doesn't work that way. And wishing hard and working hard don't always stick a crown atop your ephemerally skinny body.
Life doesn't work that way.
No.
What does that mean to you?
You know, so much of my life and my trying so hard and seeking approval has been just sheer determination. Just if there's an obstacle, I'm going to knock it down. If there's an A to make, I'm going to study all night. You know, I'm not someone who floats through life. I'm scrappy. I'm going to study all night and I'm going to do the extra credit. And that works. It can work well for a while if you're a kid or you choose to stay in academia for the rest of your life. But, you know, I made the straight A's at North Springs High School, and I did end up going to an Ivy League school after, you know, a little itinerant journey to my quote-unquote safety school.
And you had a pretty impressive academic background. I mean, you started at Northwestern, Harvard, mm-hmm. Rhodes Scholar, Oxford University. Not bad.
Thank you. I both worked really hard and I was lucky. And all of those things were so fulfilling. It was like an ATM. I mean, not an ATM, like a vending machine, right? An approval vending machine. Put in the hard work and you get out the sort of empirical approval. You win the scholarship. You get to go to the school. And then I moved to LA, and that was in my mid-20s. It was interestingly, it was right when my parents left Atlanta and moved to Florida. So I felt very homeless. I'd gone from England, where I was in grad school, to LA, and decided I had known always I wanted to be like a sitcom star. And then this sort of perfect storm happened where my mom died, and she had been my relentless approval giver my whole life, and my dealer. and I was 3,000 miles away from family, and trying to be an actor is just brutal. It was just brutal. And it didn't matter if you were smart or, you know, had once been Miss Aphrodite. There was always someone prettier than you or skinnier than you or funnier than you. And that was the big hard lesson, that working hard and wanting things doesn't mean you get them.
The most heartbreaking thing, I think, about being an actor is you could go in to an audition. You could nail the audition. You could be the best person that casting director and his team saw. But you're a couple years too old,
mm-hmm.
or they really need a blonde.
Yep.
The decisions have nothing to do with what you're saying, how hard you work, even how good you really are. That's a heartbreaking lesson to learn in a profession that you're pursuing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was terribly hard. And it took me 11 sort of lost years in LA, and I did have some success. I got to be on Star Trek. I got to be beamed up. You know, I got to be on Sex and the City, and I did an improvisational sitcom. I had some success, but not remotely what I had hoped
for.
Yeah,
but, you know, let's take these things a little more slowly, if you don't mind. You very honestly, very candidly acknowledge in your book that you were on a TV series that was named by TV Guide the 30th worst TV series of all time.
Yeah.
All time. I mean, that's a big deal.
That's a big accomplishment. Yeah. I was on for a season. It was called Unhappily Ever After.
Yeah. And you were, I looked this up. You were one position worse than a show called Homeboys in Outer Space.
What?
So you were really on a bad show.
What was
that show, Unhappily Ever After, that none of us ever saw?
It was the poor man's Married with Children. And Married with Children was bad enough. I was on that in a bikini. That was like my big break when I got to L.A. And the creator of Married with Children, who had such success with that, he just got kind of lazy. And he wanted to sort of make something derivative and not work too hard. And there was a character on the show named Floppy the Bunny, voiced by Bobcat Goldthwait, with whom I am now friendly because we do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me together. But yes, I played a goth chick on this show. And I'll tell you, I didn't get the part. I thought I gave a great audition and they gave it to somebody else. And she, after three episodes, turned out to be awful. And then they came back and asked me if I would do it. Of course I
would.
There
you go. So, you know, I thought it was interesting when I read that Bobcat Goldthwait was in that show. Is he really like that all the time?
He is so, he is such a bizarre genius. I can't tell if he's so funny and weird because he's trying to be or he just is. And he's not like that all the time. He is, when you talk to him, he's just like a normal, thoughtful guy who really, he's a very good director, and writer, and he really cares about what he does. So,
yeah. You know, it's funny. I've looked at a variety of websites that you're a part of, and
I'm so honored, by the way. You did such research.
Yeah, I try. But people are always, it's funny how many comments there are from people about you as a singer. People love you as a singer.
Aww.
And when you were doing TV, you did not get away from singing completely. Let's listen to an example, and you'll tell us what this is.
Are you tone deaf?
You're the one who's tone deaf. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
Oh, you chose the worst part.
What do you mean? Oh, it does get better.
Because then I learned to sing.
What's that from?
So that's from Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
What did you play on that show?
I don't mean to brag, but I was a genetically enhanced mutant, Bill, named Serena Douglas.
Yeah.
And because my character was so brilliant, I learned to sing within like 2 seconds. And then they gave me an aria after that.
You know what? We know you can sing because we have this to play for you.
Oh, God.
It's me.
Oh, my God.
It's really good to see you.
Yeah.
I hear you quit your job. Can't say I blame you.
Oh, my gosh.
I trust you're feeling well.
Yeah.
So 90s.
I'm really sorry for what I put you through. I hope you realize I did it all for you.
What is that, Miss Northwestern?
Oh my gosh, that was a music video, like a whole story thing called, was it Perfect Harmony? Is that what it was called?
I haven't even thought
of that. I mean, that was 1990.
All right, so let's set that
one.
Up. You had graduated from North Springs High School.
Yes.
Northwestern was calling you, right?
Yes, because not many other schools were.
But
Duke turned me down, Brown turned me down, Princeton turned me down, and Yale turned me down.
But you're at one of the finest performing arts schools in the country when you're at Northwestern.
I was,
so that's not a shabby thing.
No, it wasn't shabby. It just wasn't.
Were you in performing arts there?
I started acting in Atlanta when I was 11. So I grew up doing musical theater with the Atlanta Workshop Players. And in a company called Stage Directions.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And you know these.
Yeah, sure.
Wow.
Sure.
So I was always acting. I mean, I don't mean to brag, but I did Chick-fil-A industrials and a Six Flags Over Georgia commercial. I went to college assuming, as a 17-year-old mind does, that when you want to be an actor, you should study acting in college. And when I got to Northwestern, I realized I don't want to study acting. I know how to be an actor and I love it. I want to study history and I want to study literature and I don't want to study speech and I don't want to sew costumes.
The clip that we heard was from as you say, it was a short film.
Yeah.
Written, I assume, by a student.
Yeah, oh, yes.
The lyrics are really bad, Faith.
They're not as bad as Oogly Boogly
that they probably
made Barbara Streisand sing. The lyrics are horrible. I had nothing to do with that. I was just the vessel.
But I
was an alien. I was an alien.
Oh.
Interesting.
What? But here's the serious question. You do have a really fine singing voice, and
thanks.
We hear it in that clip. But you didn't pursue work in musical theater,
No.
I don't think. Why not?
That's kind of a regret of my life in a way. I did musicals through, definitely at Harvard and in grad school. I met Matt Damon doing a musical called My Name is Alice.
Did you make out with him?
Yes, I did.
What was that like?
He was Matt Damon even in college. He's very handsome and sexy. And I will say that he's a good kisser, but it tasted like smoke. He smoked cigarettes.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't have a future, Bill.
Why? Why didn't you have a future with Matt Damon?
Really?
Yeah.
Because I was a virgin and intended to remain a virgin, and I don't think he, at that time, was interested in what my choice was.
Okay. Fair enough.
And he was, like, interested in, and also I probably wasn't cool enough for him. Like, his I wasn't ever cool. I'm not cool, right? And he was, like, there are actually cool people at Harvard who I think don't try as hard and, you know, smoke and have sex. And I wasn't one of them.
Does Matt Damon remember you?
I don't know.
You don't? You've never had any interaction? Did you interview him on your radio show?
No, I never did. I think he'd remember me because the show that we did together was full of people who went on to be very successful and some others as famous. Not
what
as famous
was
as
that
Matt.
Show?
It was called My Name is Alice. And one of the stars of it is Chyna Forbes, who is the lead singer of Pink Martini, and Issa Davis, who has been on Broadway, and Larry O'Keefe was our musical director, and he did Bat Boy and Legally Blonde and Heathers. So I think Matt would remember.
Wow.
And now, I mean, I am sort of embarrassed that I dropped his name in my book because I mean, I think it's a little bit juicy, but also someday I might see him and he'll be like, why'd you have to go?
Well, I mean, Edward James almost probably feels this. Gosh. I'll never watch Battlestar Galactica in the same way again. What exactly happened between you and Edward James almost?
I had interviewed him on my my erstwhile radio show, Fair Game, which was a Public Radio International show. And that was by ISDN.
Which means he wasn't in the studio. It was a phone interview, but go on.
And Edward James almost has a very compelling, sexy voice. And I had interviewed him about Battlestar Galactica. Then I was asked to host an event at Comic-Con, a session on Battlestar Galactica, and he was there. He was on the panel, and I think it went well. I'm a huge fan of that show. Did you see it?
Battlestar Galactica? Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Okay. It was amazing, right?
It's maybe the greatest television series of all time.
I would not debate you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so after the discussion, he gave me a big hug. It was fairly benign. It was, you know, heartfelt, it seemed. And I didn't see him again until that night. I was at the big fancy Entertainment Weekly sci-fi channel party. It was probably 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was standing in the margarita line, and he saw me. He was right in front of me. And when I tell you he felt me up, it was very deliberate and thorough. And he leaned in, and I mean, he leaned in so close I could like hear his pockmarks, and he was like, "Your body feels amazing." And he grabbed my butt and he grabbed my cleavage.
What did you say to him?
I probably should have been much more of the feminist that I am. I kind of took his hands away and I smiled and said, "Thank you." And, I mean, you know, he said my body felt amazing. It's a nice compliment. And then I got out of the margarita line. He said, where are you staying tonight? And I said, well, I'm staying here, but my car's coming at 4 a.m., so I have to go.
So you've already mentioned it, but you really talk a lot in this book about how difficult your first marriage was. Why?
Setting up why things were so difficult for me in my first marriage and why they were so hard and the ways in which I was seeking approval, I believe make the fact that I have this incredibly happy ending with my current husband and the fact that I was with a man through my 30s who didn't want to have sex with me. And so did I really have to be deliberate in becoming a mother in my 40s? Yeah. You know, I had never been pregnant before. I froze my eggs. I happened to freeze them with a CNN camera and a CBS News camera there. But, you know, I went through a lot to have my children, a lot of miscarriages, a lot of science, a lot of praying and paying. And I think that this book, if it takes someone on a journey, as it took me on a journey with my relationship with approval, makes my gratitude seem more dramatic.
I do think we should say that coming out of that bad marriage and that terrible time in your life, part of what you did was you baked your fear into a castor oil cake at the, what, Ayurveda Center?
I can't even pronounce it. Ayurvedic Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a strip mall in Sarasota, Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. You went down there to cleanse your feelings to whatever.
Yes, to release fear and anger. This was after my husband asked me if I'd consider having an exorcism.
Instead, you bake your fear into a
castor oil cake. Yeah, the women there, the healers, suggested I, you know, yell at fear to get out of me, to go, and I wanted to please them. Right, I was there to get an A in enlightenment and spirituality. So I was yelling, you know, I'm on the massage table and they're dripping oil on my third eye and they're rubbing me and telling me to yell at fear to leave. And so I was, you know, leave, leave. And the woman, Janine, said, I don't believe you. You're acting. And I was like, oh, my. I mean, I just left Hollywood to come here to be healed. And I can't even get a gig here. I'm the world's worst actor. And so they said, you know, what do you love to do? I said, I love to bake. And they said, OK, bake fear a castor oil cake. And I had to do that in my imagination.
Well, the interesting thing about that essay in the book is that after making fun of it throughout much of the essay, the fact of the matter is you finally went through a ritual.
Yeah.
That worked.
Yeah.
And came out on the other side. And since then, CBS Sunday Morning, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, All of these wonderful things have happened to you. Great marriage, two children.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big turning point in my life. What I didn't realize I needed to release at that point in my life was grief over losing my mother in my 20s. And that loss didn't have to be sort of the story of my life. And once I did release that at this place, you know, after a bunch of enemas and yoga, what I really needed to release was sadness. And I was also releasing my first marriage and my desperate need to be a famous actress. And when I let all of those go and sort of let life lead me where I was supposed to go, which was into the glamorous world of public radio, everything changed.
Faith Saley, it's really been fun to have you here. As I said, I think Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much, your book of essays, is very funny. But as I said, I think you're very revealing and fortunately, it's in a way that moves all of us. My
Thank
one
you.
Complaint is yes. I've read the publicity for your book, and it says this is a book women will love. Well, I'm not a woman, and I thought there was a lot in there for me as
thank
well.
You.
So thank you for writing the book and for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for playing Barbara Streisand.
Find out more about Faith Saley's book, Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much, on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on the Two-Way Street Facebook page. We've also put up some videos that capture moments in her career. Now, we did not post her infamous CBS Sunday Morning essay about pets. That would just be piling on, and she's already paid the price for that one. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll have some updates about guests who've appeared on Two-Way Street recently. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. We have an update for you now on a show we did a couple of weeks back.
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
Our show on the Broadway musical Hamilton was pegged to the fact that it had just won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. But you've probably heard by now that just this week, the show won new accolades.
The nominees for Best Musical are Bright Star, Hamilton.
When nominations for the Tony Awards, which are Broadway's equivalent of the Oscars, were announced, Hamilton received 16 nominations. That's a record. Two previous musicals had been nominated for 15 Tony Awards each. The fabulously funny and totally perverse Mel Brooks show, The Producers.
It's springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and king. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes.
And the British import, Billy Elliot.
Sparks inside of me, and I'm free, I'm free, free. I'm free.
Hamilton has a chance to set another record now. It can eclipse the record for the most Tonys ever awarded to a musical. In 2001, The Producers won 12. That's the record. Hamilton's creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, was himself nominated for 3 Tonys, and no one is willing to bet he won't win all 3. So raise a glass and give a toast to Hamilton, the musical phenomenon of a generation.
Raise a glass to freedom, something they can never take away, no matter what they tell you. Raise a glass to the 4 of us. Tomorrow there'll be more of us telling the story of tonight.
We're just about out of time for this week's show, but I wanted to mention we love it when you listen to us on the radio. After all, it's good for our ratings. But you really can listen to Two Way Street according to your own schedule. You can subscribe to our podcast from iTunes or any other podcast provider. You can also download the GPB Atlanta app and listen to us there. And you can find our shows archived on our website. Our producer is the astonishingly talented Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us this week. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
Tell the story of tonight. Tell the story of